Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Recent national data shows that more Americans die from opioid overdoses than in motor vehicle accidents. In spite of increasing awareness and tighter regulation, too many of us are introduced to prescription opioids and become habituated, which can lead to drug tolerance, the effect that one needs more of the drug to achieve the same effect, and to outright addiction, in which it feels impossible to stop. This in turn can lead to devastation of individuals, families, and communities. My guest today, journalist Chris McGreal, is a longtime correspondent for The Guardian, the worldwide newspaper site that originated in Manchester, England. Based in the U.S. for a decade now, he has a new book out about the U.S. opioid crisis called American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts, just out from Public Affairs. The book reads like a thriller covering different characters and communities impacted by opioids, with attention also given to the macro level of how we got here and how our health services, government, and law enforcement agencies are trying to cope with the problem. McGreal was in Tulsa recently for an event with Magic City Books, and I interviewed him live on stage at All Souls Unitarian Church. Chris McGreal, correspondent for The Guardian and author of American Overdose, is our guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday.
One of the things that's very unusual about this epidemic is that it begins with middle-aged people. There are some interesting demographics about it. If you look at the early years, it's the larger number of people who become addicted and who overdose tend to be between 45 and 55. And that's partly because those are the people most in need of some form of pain therapy. And these were communities that had often fallen back. There were mining communities, there were logging communities. You had people that had worked, whose bodies really were wrecked by their life, by their hard work. And they had found some form of therapy in the past. Perhaps it was moonshine, perhaps it was marijuana in more recent times. It was other forms of pain pills. And what you see is when the first opioid pills come onto the markets in the 1990s, they start targeting these communities. And on the back of that, you see people like Henry Vinson come in and set up these pain clinics in these communities to just churn out as many prescriptions as possible. And it begins with people who are referred by their primary care doctors, but it soon expands. And over a period of a decade, what you see is that this pill mill becomes the largest supplier of opioids really through an entire region. People are coming from Tennessee, from Florida, from Ohio to get pills, because the way it works is that a doctor, there's a doctor called Catherine Hoover, who's one of the doctors that he's recruited, and she he looked around to find doctors that he knew would just dodgy doctors that would just go along with prescribing, making money. And Catherine Hoover, one of the first doctors he recruited was actually the doctor from the physician from the federal prison he'd just been released from. So he gets him on board, a guy called Reichman. And then he finds Catherine Hoover. And Catherine Hoover's just about to lose her medical license in Florida because, astonishingly, it has been discovered that she has inviting her teenage female patients to have sex with her teenage son in return for no bills, which is remarkable. Anyway, she ends up in West Virginia, and then there's a doctor called Diane Schaefer who has lost her license in neighbouring Kentucky for, amongst other things, bribery. So these doctors and others are all in this pill mill. And the way it works is that you come, you see the doctor, you pay $150 in cash, she writes a prescription, and then she never wants to see you again. You just turn up every month, slap down your $150 of cash at reception, and you get your prescription, which is illegal. A doctor is supposed to see you, they have to sign the prescription in front of you. This is how it works, for at least for opioids. But the advantage of not seeing patients is, of course, you can have as many prescriptions as you want. You just pre-sign them, they'll all sit there blank. And within a few years, Catherine Hoover is writing more prescriptions than West Virginia's largest hospital. Over a period of a decade, through the 2000s, she manages to write, on average, 300 prescriptions a day. Now, you can't possibly see 300 patients a day. And when they finally bust her, the FBI and others bust her, they find so much money, they make so much cash, that there are millions of dollars lying around, stuffed into bank vaults, stuffed into cars, into their offices, under their beds at home. There is so much cash. And the pill mill itself was estimated to be taking in $5 million a year in a town of 3,000 people.
So, you know, if this were just a story, just some reporting alone, it would be, you know, an interesting story, a sad story, and kind of full of these, you know, colorful, arguably, or corrupt characters. But this was really emblematic of a much wider systematic problem. And it was really a perfect storm of events and our federal policies and then business practices that occurred in the United States really from the 1990s on into the early aughts that led to what we now definitely ascribe as the opioid epidemic. And so there are many, I would say, villains in your stories, but perhaps none more so in characters in the book than a company called Purdue Pharma. And then you are pretty critical of the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. So I guess let's start with Purdue Pharma. Who are they and how do they enter into the story for those that don't know?
One of the reasons the book's called American Overdose is because this is, and it's one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, is this epidemic is pretty much a uniquely American phenomenon. There's a bit of this in Canada, but it's next door, right? So, but you don't see this in most other developed countries. And then the other thing is that it's gone on for 20 years. How is it that an epidemic can grow for 20 years? And really, we're sitting here now having this conversation. Why are we having this conversation 15 years ago? And at the beginning of it, like many things, it comes out of good intentions. And you have, at the beginning, you have two groups of people. You have a very well-meaning group of doctors, and they felt that pain was undertreated in the United States. They felt that there were too many people suffering. And they looked to an example, actually, that had come out of the UK, which was the hospice movement, where that had grown in the 50s and 60s, the use of opioids to treat people who were dying of cancer. And the argument, the very sensible argument, was if you're dying, it doesn't really matter if you become addicted. The point is to suppress the pain and to go as painlessly as possible. And that movement came to the United States. And then you see a group of doctors led by a doctor called Russell Portnoy, who say, well, if we're using it for end-of-life care, why can't we use it for all those people that come in to see us who have chronic pain, really debilitating chronic pain in their lives? Can't we help them? And so there was a genuinely good intention there. But then it starts to go off the rails, because Portnoy says, well, the big problem in getting these drugs to people is stigma. The medical profession is hostile to the prescribing of opioids because they believe they're highly addictive. And that's a legacy of an earlier epidemic which happened after the Civil War, when because of all the battlefield wounds, there was very high use of morphine, and that changed into a national epidemic that actually led to the appointment of the country's first drug czar in 1910 by Teddy Roosevelt. And that drug czar at the time described Americans as the world's worst drug fiends. So Portnoy decides, we've got to break this down. So what he does is he starts fixing the evidence, in essence. What they do is they take these small studies of people who've used opioids and say, look, here's the evidence that they're not addictive. They took a letter that had appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine in the 80s, which showed a 1% addiction rate. But in fact, it was talking about something very, very narrow and couldn't be applied to the general population. And there were plenty of other examples of this. And they took this evidence, and Portnoy now admits this. He says, we were just trying to break down the stigma. And they said, look, here's the evidence that these drugs firstly work, and two, that they're safe. And so all these fears are unreasonable. And that was a misrepresentation of the science. It was actually junk science, but it was pushed by these doctors, and nobody really looked at what they were saying. They just took it at face value. And then, as ever, you see the drug companies see an opportunity. And there's this company called Purdue Pharma. And there were already opioids on the market, but they were very controlled in how they were prescribed. But Purdue Pharma decided that it needed a new drug. And it had a drug that was already used for end-of-life care. And it took that drug and it essentially remodeled it, gave it a coating that said it would release into your body very slowly, pumped loads of morphine into it, so it's very, very high strength, and then said this drug is more effective and safer than any other opioid that's been on the market before. And that wasn't true. It was a claim based entirely on pseudoscience, But they made that claim, and they got the FDA, and this is the crucial thing, they got the Food and Drug Administration to endorse that claim, to say it was true. And what you see is that that drug goes onto the market, and then, crucially, what Purdue Pharma is able to do is to persuade the FDA that this drug can be used for moderate to severe pain. And the moderate's key, because basically moderate covers any pain. What it means is that this drug, if you go in to see your doctor and your toe hurts, this drug could be prescribed. But it was a very, very high-strength drug, and it wasn't safer. In fact, didn't. The idea that it was safe was based on that it bled into your system over 12 hours, and that it would work longer, and because of this special coating, you couldn't get high from it. But that wasn't true. It didn't last for 12 hours. Often it wore off much quicker, so people took more of the drug, so they're getting more, effectively, heroin in a pill. But also, the claims for it being more effective weren't true either. But this drug is unleashed onto the market, backed by the FDA, saying it's safer and more effective. And the idea that it can be prescribed for any form of pain.
And at the same time as this is going on, and Purdue Pharma is marketing the heck out of this drug directly to doctors and in medical journals and through detail people and luncheons and people coming to the offices saying these things. This drug is better, it's more effective, and it's safer. So you have this strong marketing message. At the same time, the commission that accredits hospitals and healthcare organizations in the United States decides through this movement that we're not treating this chronic problem of pain, which incidentally, one of the doctors you interviewed said that there's 100 million Americans with chronic pain. So one out of every three people suffers with chronic pain. So pain is an epidemic. We've got to take it more seriously. Pain becomes the fifth vital sign. And this was something where I was training as a physician and literally was told pain is the fifth vital sign. You must address a patient's pain first and foremost. Their blood pressure, their temperature, their pulse, and how much pain are they in? Well, we don't have a way to really measure pain except what somebody tells us. So this kind of adds fuel to the fire.
Yeah, I mean, Purdue does two things, and it's not the only guilty party here. It just is the initiator. But when it sends its salespeople out, it tells doctors, this is the drug, OxyContin, is the drug to begin with and to stay with. And later it will deny it did this, but in fact it's been proven and it was convicted in court of doing this because it was illegal. But it persuaded doctors that this was the one-stop drug. Really, really high-strength heroin pill, in effect, for any form of pain. So it's got that going. But at the same time, Purdue and then other opioid manufacturers get on board. They see the potential here. So it's not just Purdue. It's companies like Endo, which make drugs like Percocet and Vicodin, which are lower-strength drugs. But they all see the opportunity here. And essentially, they set out to take control of medical policy. They realize that they need to influence how these drugs are prescribed. And one of the ways that they do it is through pushing the idea of pain as the fifth vital sign. You go to the doctor, normally you get asked, you know, your heart rate is measured, your blood pressure is measured. These are all things that can be tested. They latched on to the idea that you could also be, your pain could be measured. But of course, only you can measure your pain. Only you know how much pain you're in. It's why you see those smiley faces in the clinics. That whole idea. And the idea being that doctors will be obligated to treat pain if you say it's more than 5 on the scale. And what develops then is that they start to take actually control of medical policy. And one way is through something called the Joint Commission. The Joint Commission licenses hospitals in this country. And without that license, a hospital can't get federal funds for Medicaid, Medicare and that. So they need that license. And hospitals are very nervous of not adhering to the Joint Commission's statutes, and the Joint Commission keeps a very close rein on these things. So the Joint Commission sends out what is technically guidance, but in practice is an edict, saying you have to introduce pain as a fifth vital sign. And it does this under pressure, for want of a better word, from the pharmaceutical companies, but also a financial incentive. And the financial incentive is that Purdue Pharma goes to the Joint Commission and says, what we'll do is we will write the medical policy for you that you can then sell to all the hospitals and the doctors and make money out of it. And that's exactly what happens. So the Joint Commission requires these hospitals to follow procedures that are actually written by Purdue Pharma. And then the Joint Commission makes money out of selling them to the doctors and the hospitals. So in an instant, there's the financial relationship. This happens with other medical bodies. A lot of state medical bodies essentially end up doing a very similar thing. But right throughout the system, you get this idea of the fifth vital sign pushed. And hospitals become very concerned about not adhering to that. So there's enormous pressure on doctors. But the pressure also comes from insurance companies, because insurance companies look and think, well, prescribing an opioid, that's nice and cheap compared to physical therapy or dealing with the stress or all the other things. There's so many different ways that you can have pain, but prescribing an opioid is quick, you're in and out the door in 10 minutes, and it's cheap. And added to the pressure on the doctors, the Joint Commission decides it needs to know if doctors are adhering to this. So what they do is they require patient satisfaction surveys about pain. Now, your average patient that goes in wanting a pill for pain is not going to be very satisfied if they sit down and the doctor says, actually, you need to eat less, you need to exercise more, you need to do something about your diabetes, you need to do this, that, and the other. These are, you know, you need to deal with the stress in your life, whatever it might be. So they give them zero or one, and then the hospital comes down on the doctor. The doctor says, this really isn't worth the grief. And the insurance company saying, why are you spending half an hour talking to this person about, you know, their physical condition when you could just prescribe them a pill and have them out the door and see the next person? So you can see how all of this builds up. This is in the very late 90s and the early 2000s.
Now, there is some very bleak aspects to the book, and this West Virginia town is chief among them. I mean, it just seems like there's just an absolute poverty in every way, poverty of purpose that you portray, but there are heroes in the stories as well. But as with all sort of social movements or epidemics, they're often not heard at first because the machine, these forces that you describe, are very powerful in terms of keeping this status quo. And for example, there are people who start to see these numbers and these trends in terms of the number of deaths, the number of early deaths, and start to call attention to it. And they're not really heard. And one of the places where we would expect there to be some movement on this would be the FDA. And in fact, the FDA was very slow in reacting to this. Where there was probably the most beneficial pressure, if we want to call it that, is probably from the CDC eventually. One of the things that surprised me was really the lack of attention the Obama administration paid to the opioid epidemic. We tend to, especially now, I think, in the Trump era, remember the Obama era very fondly in many ways, but they were not very, they did not lead the way, I would say, in this regard. But it was, I guess, Tom Frieden, who was Obama's head of the CDC, who really kind of changed some of the dialogue around this. But there are other characters. I mean, one of the stories I was hoping you'd tell was about a drug called Zohydra, which in the midst of all of this going on, we're now much more aware as a country, the stories are coming out about the dangers of opioid overuse, overprescribing. This very potent, long-acting opioid is being tested or going up for approval at the FDA, and the small panel that looks at it votes overwhelmingly to deny approval, but in the end the drug is allowed to be put on the market. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. I mean, when I was reporting this, one of the things that really leapt out at me is if this epidemic kind of has its roots 20 years ago is you know, why weren't the alarm bells being rung? If you go to these communities in West Virginia or Eastern Kentucky, they'll tell you that by the late 90s, early 2000s, they were really feeling the effects of this. And when you look at it, they were being run. There's a doctor called Jane Ballantyne, and she was head of pain management at Harvard University and its associated hospital, Massachusetts General. And she buys into the idea that actually people need these pills and that they're the only means of treatment until she starts to look at her patients. And she starts to see that a couple of things have happened. One is that actually over 2 or 3 years, her patients aren't in less pain. They're taking more and more pills, but their pain is not diminishing. And then the other thing she sees is that they have changed. And she's got their families coming and saying, you know, my husband, my son is not the same person. These drugs have changed them. And she writes, she does the studies, and she writes a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2003 saying, actually, we need to pause. The claims made for opioids, for the wide prescribing of opioids. There's no evidence for it. We haven't done the clinical trials. And in my own studies show that, in fact, this is doing more harm than good. And you see a succession of people. There's a Dr. Goodart Van Zee in Virginia who sees his community being really badly hit by this, a mining community. There's a doctor, a very senior surgeon, been a surgeon since the 60s, Detroit General, who thinks his patients post-surgery are dying because they're being given too many opioids and writes about this. And what you see at that moment is the pharmaceutical industry wake up and realize that, as a US senator put it to me, that their candy was going to be taken away. And so they decide to change the discussion. I'm getting to your point about the FDA and Sahydra, I promise you. They decide to change the discussion. And what they do is they say, yes, okay, there are people who are becoming addicted, yes, but it paints them as at fault. It blames them. It blames the victims. And it starts to create this idea that there are two groups of people. There are the good pain patients, and then there are these bad addicts. And we mustn't take away the pills from the good pain patients just because these abusers over here. The fact that very many people who became addicted had done so through following their prescriptions legitimately was completely shunned aside. But the industry pours millions of dollars into pushing this narrative that we mustn't take away. They call it the balanced approach, and it drives actually quite a lot of doctors nuts, because what they say is it's not a balanced approach at all. It's just about keeping the door to mass prescribing of these drugs open and keeping the profits flowing. But what happens is the FDA buys into this idea. Yes, we must have a balanced approach. There is a problem with addiction, but we mustn't do anything to interfere with the need for people to have opioids. And they keep approving more and more drugs coming on the market for very, very wide prescribing. And then what you see by about 2012, by which time there's hundreds of opioids on the market, you start to see that the FDA is under public pressure. Finally, people are saying, well, if there's one agency that should be able to address this, it should be the Food and Drug Administration. Why isn't it doing it? And even the doctors themselves inside the FDA are saying, we need to do something about this. We need to start considering the broader public health issue here. And in 2012, there's a new drug up for approval. And it's a drug that's previously been rejected, actually, for other reasons. But it's called Zohydro, and it's a very high-strength opioid. And the way the FDA works is it has these committees that recommend whether a drug should be approved or not, and they have public hearings. And the people on the committee are generally scientists and doctors, specialists. And Zohydro is a very high-strength opioid, very similar to OxyContin, very, very similar in every way. And the FDA senior FDA official responsible for this is a guy called Dr. Bob Rappaport. And Dr. Bob Rappaport had a very interesting relationship with the drug industry, in that for a decade, secretly, the FDA officials, including Rappaport, was meeting drug industry executives who were paying $40,000 a time to be at the table with FDA officials responsible for approving opioids to write the opioid policies. And these were technically organized by academics, but clearly it was a pay-to-play arrangement, and if it wasn't, it wouldn't have been so secret for 10 years. So this drug comes up, and the members of the panel, the scientists and the doctors, clearly by 2012, everybody knows there's an epidemic, and they have questions. And they say, listen, why are we letting another drug on the market? There's people dying out there. Why aren't we actually acting to rein in some of those drugs that are already out there? Why are they being so widely prescribed? Why don't we, if we're going to approve another drug, make it much narrower, only for severe pain, only in very specific circumstances? We can't just go on doing this. And Rappaport essentially says to them, that's not your job. You don't get to consider the public health. That's not the issue here. The issue here, and this is the phrase he used, is he said, the issue is a level playing field for industry. And by that, he went on to explain that if there was a drug already on the market, like OxyContin, then any other company had a right to also market a similar drug. And all that this panel could do was consider whether this drug was any worse than OxyContin. Now, when OxyContin was approved, people didn't know how bad it was going to be. By 2012, it was quite clear just how bad it was. But he told them that they could not consider the wider public health. They had to only consider whether this drug was any worse than OxyContin or another drug called Opana. The doctors rebelled. They voted 11-2. No, we're not going to do that. There was uproar at the meeting. They were saying, how can you tell us we can't consider the public health? This is an epidemic. This is madness. They vote 11-2 to say we reject this drug. Everybody goes home, and 6 months later, the FDA approves the drug anyway.
Yeah, that was stunning.
And they've just done the same in November, but something very similar, with a new drug called Dysuvia.
And there's... You give a number of how many are in the pipeline? How many new...
58. Well, last I looked, there were 58 new opioids up for consideration.
So we're very ambivalent about our desire to fight the opioid epidemic. And, of course, we don't want to deprive people in need from pain relief. So you contrast the Obama administration. President Trump has had some very strong words about many things, but about the opioid crisis. He's been very... I would say that his rhetoric about it, if you think of the opioid crisis as a crisis, as a problem, as an epidemic, this is one area in which his rhetoric has been very welcomed, but I don't think there's been a lot of action.
Well, there's been more action than there has under previous presidents, but there's the bill that went through Congress, the $8 billion to go towards treatment and other things. But when you consider that this, by the White House's only calculations, this epidemic is probably going to cost $1 trillion in total. And we've already got 250,000 dead, and the figures probably are much higher than that, the real figures. They're probably closer to 500,000. And there are people that study this stuff that say before this runs its course, there'll probably be a similar number of deaths. So in those terms, when you look at it in those terms, 8 billion isn't that much. Actually, I think the real difference has been communities on the ground. They're all changing things. And then there are all these legal suits, which probably will generate a very large amount of money comparable to the tobacco settlement. So, yeah, the president certainly has acknowledged it, and certainly there has been some more action. And I will say that the Trump appointed a commission to look into the opioid epidemic. And the commission's report is really very, very good. It identifies a lot of what I'm talking about where the failures were. It names the FDA very specifically, but a whole bunch of other institutions. America's full of federal institutions that supposedly have a responsibility for drug abuse. There's a National Institute for Drug Abuse, which you would think would be, you know, out there on the front lines. And it didn't do a thing. There's SAMHSA, and the first two words of SAMHSA are substance abuse. Again, it did nothing. None of these federal agencies really stepped up and did anything. They all found reasons why not. No, we only look at, you know, treatment, or we only look at this, that, and the other. I do think that, at the very least, the commission, Trump's commission, identified what had gone wrong, and it also identified a lot of what needs to be done in the future, including cutting the levels of prescribing. So that was actually one, you know, quite a very important thing he did.
Chris McGreal is a correspondent for The Guardian and author of the book American Overdose: The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. I interviewed him live on stage at All Souls Unitarian Church as an event for Magic City Books. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed any of our shows, you can stream them online anytime on a smartphone, a tablet, or a computer. Just go to our website, studiotulsa.org. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.